Welcome to Embracing Continuous Behaviour Change for Anger Management, the podcast that helps you to calm your emotions and communicate effectively. I'm your host, Claire Broadley, the Anger Management Coach. In this podcast, I'll bring you expert interviews, inspiring stories, and practical advice on calming your emotions and living a more peaceful and fulfilling life. So sit back, relax, and get ready to master your emotions. So good afternoon on this. It's very wet and windy here. Don't know whereabouts. Whereabouts are you at the minute, Mo?
I am in North London at the moment.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
What's the weather like there?
It's very wet and windy here as well. I've got washing out, which is a tragedy.
Yeah. So welcome everyone to listening to our podcast today. So I have got the lovely Mo Ford with me today, who is the director of Live and Breathe Coaching Limited, a coach, facilitator and performance psychology practitioner. What is a performance psychology practitioner?
Oh, it's a good question that I'm probably going to give a long answer to.
Well, you can go on. Tell us about you, Mo.
So, well, let me try and answer the performance psychology bit succinctly. I actually started out with a couple of different focuses and things that I was doing with my life. And one was working in the not-for-profit sector, working in lots of different kind of charity settings, supporting people who'd been through quite difficult things, a lot of complex and kind of traumatic things in their lives. And then I was also involved in music and singing. And when I was younger, I really struggled with sort of performance anxiety, with like nerves and finding it really difficult sometimes to get up in front of people and perform. And it was really situation specific. Sometimes it was difficult. Sometimes I was like, this is the best time ever. I'm having an amazing time. And I got really interested in why that was. And there wasn't really a lot of support when I was younger, you know, and kind of exploring the world of performance in the 90s, there wasn't a huge amount of support for that. At some point, I hit a bit of a crisis, and I lost my voice. I injured my vocal folds.
Okay.
And the support that I found for that, you know, I had all the clinical support through the NHS, but I found some practitioners who were experts in performance psychology and the psychology of voice and things like that, and we're doing doctoral research on that. So one of the people who supported me is called Dr. Denise Borland, and she did a load of performance psychology support with me around what's going on with the performance side of things, and also the kind of recovery and what happens when you can't express yourself, what's the emotional impact of that, and did a load of work on helping me get into my body. So I went off and did training in things like breath work and somatic trauma work and all of this sort of stuff. And then I also trained as a coach. This was not the succinct answer at all, but that is my story.
I'm listening. It's very interesting.
So, yeah, I got really interested in a sort of holistic approach to how people express themselves, how people communicate, whether that's in performance and presentation or how people communicate with each other in relationship. And I started working with organizations and doing organizational work around things like equity, diversity and inclusion, or helping people manage conflict. And I just got really interested in the both the psychology of all of that and also what was going on in people's bodies, and how I might be able to help them regulate their nervous systems, so that they could show up to difficult conversations more easily from a place of calm and not get really triggered, get really defensive and angry, and you know, struggle to hear each other. So basically a lot of different experiences, personal and professional experiences that I had, all sort of came together. And I must admit, figuring out how to describe that to people is one of the challenges, because there's so many different parts to what I do, and coming up with a title that explains it all can be an interesting one. So you tend to get the long version of the story, but I think it's more interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you talked about kind of, and that's a lot of what I do, is we look at how people are communicating and they're having this storm, aren't they, almost inside them, of they've got so much to say, but they don't know how to say it. So it comes out in, I don't know, words, anger, fists, all sorts of different ways. And then we've got those people, coaches, counsellors, psychologists, etc., who have to then, don't have to do it, but they then help those people to overcome those types of traumas and those types of problems with communication. And we quite often hear a lot of words like, for example, burnout and preventing burnout and traumas and all of that lot. So what, if we talk about burnout, what is your kind of thoughts around what does that look like? What is that?
Yeah, I think there's lots of ways that burnout can show up, and it's a real hot topic at the moment. Of course it is, because we live in a world where, you know, people's working hours are based on an assumption of single income households, and then living costs don't really allow that, and it's not for everyone anyway. And then, you know, we have kind of unlimited access to information about what's going on in the world 24/7. A lot of traumatic and difficult, horrific things going on out there, good things as well, but you know, that can be overwhelming. And then we've got all these kind of different types of sensory input all vying for our attention around the clock as well, you know, and the kind of economic crisis, environmental crisis. It's just a lot, isn't it, for us all to deal with. So it's no wonder that people are feeling like perhaps they're overwhelmed. I think with burnout, you know, burnout and overwhelm, there's that real kind of relationship there. And maybe they're feeling like their tank, their energy tank is empty. You've got nothing left to give. And that might look like kind of task paralysis, like not being able to get started or keep on top of the things that we have to do. It might look like irritability and kind of anger and damaged relationships. It might be about a lack of motivation and not being able to sort of care about the things that otherwise would be really important to us. And, you know, you spoke about people who support people, your coaches, therapists, and, you know, people who do what we do. And there's, you know, there's that heightened risk of burnout for us as well if we're not careful, because we're taking on so much of other people's challenges and struggles. And if we don't have somewhere to process all of that and to some way of letting it go, then we're very much kind of at risk of getting to a place where we might be able to say, I just can't do it today. I've not got enough in my tank to kind of show up. So, you know, I think whether we're supporting others in that type of formalized role as a coach or a therapist or, professional supportive person, or whether we're doing that in a less formal way and we're kind of supporting family, friends, community, that it's really, really important that we have somewhere to take the stuff that we don't want to be carrying around because it doesn't belong to us or it's not helping us.
Yeah.
You know, some way of kind of letting go. Otherwise, I think we're really kind of at risk of doing ourselves a bit of kind of psychological damage, of impacting our work, of impacting our relationships. So I think that's why we're seeing the concept of burnout being spoken about all over the place. And I don't mind adding to that conversation, because I think it's so important at the moment. I just keep hearing about people being overworked, overloaded, you know, and they just don't have it in them anymore to keep caring.
As you were describing it before, I was literally imagining almost like one of these slot machines with all the bright noises and the flashing lights, etc. That's almost what life has become, isn't it? Is we're trapped within this slot machine of life that demands so much of our attention. And we've now burdened ourselves with these little mini computers that we carry around that people can get hold of us when we're in the bath, on the toilet, wherever. We can't get away from it. So it's no wonder, as you say, that people are getting stressed, burnt out, traumatized by it. And when we talked about professionals, so there's something called vicarious trauma, isn't it? And so tell me a bit more about that, because from what I know of it, that is when we are listening to others or we're hearing their traumas and we are almost taking that on, and we're not able to kind of move on from that. Explain that to me a bit if you can.
Yeah, so I think that's a really good explanation, definition of vicarious trauma.
The rubbish one.
Well, I think it's straightforward in terms of saying that when we're supporting somebody else, when we're listening to or helping somebody else who's gone through or going through a traumatic situation, and we start to feel some of the effects of that trauma as if we were going through it ourselves, that's what it means. Honestly, the mechanism for how that works, I don't think I could tell you, but we are, as humans, we're sort of wired for connection and for empathy, really, you know, because we're pack animals, essentially. Out in the harshness of the world as we were evolving, you know, we wouldn't have really survived very well on our own. And I think, and socially, we don't necessarily, most of us don't survive very well on our own. So we're really wired to connect and to empathize. You know, we've got mirror neurons and all of that in our brains, where that's really kind of building connection, where we can start to feel what other people feel and we can sort of start mirroring their movements unconsciously and things like that. So I guess that might be part of the picture, but that's a layperson's explanation, I suppose, of how that might be working. But we are just so set up to be in relationship and in connection with other people. So when we're really listening and empathizing with somebody who has gone through something very traumatic, it might feel as if we've experienced it ourselves, or equally it might trigger traumas that we've experienced ourselves. It might kind of re-traumatize or remind us in a very kind of physical, like visceral way of something that we've experienced ourselves. And that is something that we need to sort of guard against if we're regularly working with people who've been through a lot of traumatic experiences, because I think, you know, these things can build on each other, it can be cumulative. And so again, what we need to have is a sort of safety valve, a kind of way of letting some of that go and processing the impact that it has, listening to really difficult experiences or witnessing them. And you know, even aside from vicarious trauma in its kind of truest sense, where, you know, we might be experiencing things like we might have kind of physical symptoms, sort of tension in our body or dissociation, where we kind of disconnect from our bodies or from reality, or we might get really defensive or be on the lookout for threats everywhere, or, you know, again, it might damage our relationships or physical health, all of these things. But aside from that experience, I suppose what is related to that, and maybe even more common, would be compassion fatigue, which I think is something a lot of people will experience at some point, and is related to burnout, where if we are giving out and giving out and we're supporting people on an ongoing basis and we're just doing a lot for others, whether that is as a professional or, you know, a kind of leader in the community or a parent or a child of an elderly parent or relative or, you know, whatever that looks like, if we are constantly having to show compassion and empathy and care for others, but we're not then being able to attend to our own needs, refill our own tanks, at a certain point we're likely to get kind of our capacity for compassion and empathy is going to burn out. Not permanently. It doesn't mean you become a person who doesn't have that, but you can lose your contact with your compassion and empathy for others. And I think we've probably all experienced it makes me think of things like people who are really overworked, doing fantastic jobs and really underappreciated and underpaid and all that in the NHS or in education or all these kind of caring settings, who are just go, there isn't enough support, there isn't enough time off and opportunity to meaningfully do self-care. And we've probably all come across a person who is in that situation that, you know, just our presence there adding to their workload by turning up, you know, to be seen at the GP or whatever it is really making their day worse, and they're really very irritated about it, you know. That's compassion fatigue quite often.
Absolutely. And I think, do you know what, as we talk about it, I can honestly say I have absolutely had compassion fatigue at points. And I know one particular person who I have had compassion fatigue with, because they took too much of my energy. So I felt I had absolutely nothing left. So not only nothing left for them, but nothing left for me, because it was so draining. So in those cases, how can we become more resilient? What can we do?
That's a great question. I think so much of it is about how we manage our boundaries and permission to manage our boundaries, where, you know, we might need to evaluate our own needs and kind of think, what do I need to say yes to? What do I need to say no to? And if I'm saying yes reluctantly, what's that about? Where is that coming from? You know, is it, do I have this kind of desire to feel needed and useful, and what might that be about? Or is it that I don't think I've got permission to say no, or it's just this is what's expected of me? And in some cases, actually, that might be true. If you're in a work situation, for example, where your workload is unrealistic, you might be worried about the consequences of saying no, and that becomes a kind of, I could go off on a political rant here, you know, join a union and advocate, you know, self-advocate, get together, all that. And absolutely, I think that is part of the picture. But before I spend half an hour talking about that, I think, how we evaluate and manage our boundaries is important. So like saying yes and meaning it, saying no and meaning it, and sort of taking the time to think about, do I have the capacity actually to take that on? And I think when it's in relationship with somebody, you know, like when you spoke about the person who was really draining your energy, it was kind of making me think about the nature of different relationships and how if a relationship is really truly strong enough and healthy enough, that it can withstand a bit of kind of conflict and a bit of rupture. Yeah. You can kind of repair that again, and you can say no and practice saying no. Discuss the fact that, you know, this is about me. I need to, I'm at risk of burnout here. I need to look after my needs. I hope you can understand if I need to, if there's a change in what I say yes to, all of that. Some relationships won't maybe withstand that, but, you know, my hope would be that if there's something there that is mutually valued and people have got the ability to cope with a bit of turbulence, that going from a person who says yes all the time to suddenly throwing in a few no's, it doesn't have to be a kind of relationship ender. So there's that. I think boundaries are really, really important. But also the self-care piece, the bit about how we use our resources for our own well-being feels really important to me. Things like, so personally, I like to have a list. And I like to have a list that's available to me before I need it, so that when I do need it, if I'm at the stage where I'm like, I'm really struggling, I don't know what I need, that there's something to refer to that I've thought about when I was in a better state of of mind and I had a bit more energy. But, you know, sort of things that can help us to re-energize, to kind of refill the tank, as it were, or to take some time out and let go of other people's stuff that we might be carrying around, let go of worries about other people and take some time out to really focus on ourselves. I think all of that stuff is really important as well.
My dog has gone off because someone's come across the road.
Okay. No. How dare they?
I know. Gosh, how can we have somebody else living across the street? He'll shut up in a minute. What was I going to say then? My brain. So on the subject of saying no, I actually did a live last week where I talked about boundaries and that giving yourself permission to say no. And also, and somebody made a comment and said, I don't think it's right that you should just say no and end it at that. I think you should always give a reason. So we had a bit of a debate over, do we have to say no, do we not? And I think, again, that can very much depend upon the circumstances of, if it's a boundary almost, then no can be that sentence of, no, I'm not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, I don't know, if we're trying to be politer, then absolutely. But do we have to give a reason why something is red flagging us and we're putting those boundaries up saying no and backing up?
Yeah, I think no is a complete sentence. I agree that it might be quite context specific. There might be some situations where we're maybe invested enough in the relationship, or we've got a reason to want to or need to explain why we've said no. But I think if it's just out of a sense of general politeness and social pressure, that's an interesting one, because I think that there are identity related elements to that. So, for example, gender. I think that there can be pressure, particularly on women, to be accommodating.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I know from somebody who's sort of read as female,
mm-hmm.
can be surprising or kind of cause a bit of, you know, a reaction sometimes in people. And that's the type of situation where I think just a no with a full stop as a whole sentence is a great kind of putting down of boundaries. But other times, you know, maybe we might want to say, no, I can't do that because I just don't have the capacity right now. And it might feel important to let that person know.
Yeah.
We might care about the relationship that we have with that person, whether that's personal or professional or whatever, you know. So I think it depends. Yeah.
And I absolutely do agree. And I think as a people pleaser and a prolific yes user, then for me to suddenly say no is very, very empowering, because I feel like I've taken that power back. And if I've got red flags waving in my face now saying, no, Claire, let's not do this, then I'm absolutely going to listen to them now, because it's there for a reason.
Yeah.
And why do I want to put myself through X, Y, and Z of how it's going to make me feel by saying yes?
Yeah.
So you're an advocate for proactive measures like communication, nervous system regulation, and body awareness. Mm-hmm. So can you walk us through or talk us through how you incorporate these into your daily life to prevent burnout and compassion fatigue?
Yeah. Although I feel like there's always a caveat for me with this, where I'm not saying it's do as I say, not as I do, but I think I just identify with the struggle of keeping up a daily practice really consistently. Yeah. I'm really good at using my resources when I need them, but I'm still working on using them when I don't need them, but I do advocate for that. So that's just my really honest, authentic opener for that question. But yeah, I have found embodied approaches really, really helpful personally over the years, which is why I've ended up, you know, being a practitioner in a lot of this stuff. And that can be about taking some time or taking some support to learn what your sort of warning signs and bodily sensations mean. Okay. The example that I tend to use is that I learned quite a long time ago that when I feel exposed or like there's a risk of conflict or rejection or some kind of social risk, I feel this sort of vibrating in the back of my neck.
Okay.
It's the way that I interpret this, which might sound a bit odd and I'm going off into kind of bodywork land, is that there's a sort of threatening of a freeze response.
Okay.
Kind of tussle with, like, are we going to go into... for those who can't see me, I'm tensing up my muscles. You know, am I going to go into a freeze response here?
Yeah.
Because I feel exposed and I just want to kind of, you know, do that thing that that animals do, where if I stay very still... nobody will be able to see me. You know, that sort of response. So when I start to feel that little vibration in the back of my neck, I might be like, oh, okay, I need to re-regulate. I need to take a breath in my belly. That will help me to kick in my parasympathetic nervous system response, but which is the fancy way of saying it will help me to calm down. so, you know, people love to throw around stuff about take a breath. And I think sometimes people can almost feel like that's offensive because they're going through such overwhelming stuff. How is just taking a breath going to help? Yeah. Well, honestly, you have to learn you kind of need to learn the techniques again, when you don't need them.
Yeah, absolutely.
In order for that to really, really work when you do need them.
Yeah.
But I get that it can sound a bit, you know, like, oh,
it's
just take
like
a breath.
It's almost like offhandish, isn't it? Just take a breath.
Yeah, when it's not that simple. However, I do find kind of connected breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, really, really useful in re-regulating myself when I need it. So I use that a lot. And I, as I say, I become aware of what what's that feeling in my belly? Is that anger? Is that excitement? Is that anxiety? Like, let me just try and figure out what that means, and then I can respond accordingly. And some emotions feel quite similar to each other in the body,
yeah,
and we might get them mixed up for each other. So like anxiety and excitement are the classic ones where, you know, we might feel a bit excited and a bit nervous about something.
Yeah.
But because the physical experience of that is so similar, you know, there's a sort of feedback loop where we're telling our brain, oh gosh, I'm really nervous, I'm really anxious. And that starts to really kick in the anxiety response more strongly for real. So getting to know our own, it's different for everyone, but getting to know our own signs and kind of somatic experiences and interpreting them a little bit, and then learning to respond to them, to find ways to ground ourselves, can be really helpful. So I find I've got a diagnosis of ADHD that I got in my late 30s, and I'm learning so much about what that means and how that impacts me.
Yeah.
And you know, it's things like it being quite difficult to sort of regulate my emotions without having to put work into it, and real sort of justice sensitivity and sort of emotional impulsivity and things like that, which are the sort of lesser known parts of the ADHD neurotype. And so I need to work at sort of not following my first initial emotional reaction to something when I disagree with someone or I feel a bit triggered by something that somebody said, or, you know, I come across a stressful day-to-day situation, the buses, you know, whatever it is, not to have a big kind of emotional reaction to that. And I need to get my body involved in helping myself to just come back to a place of being calm and being present in the moment instead of away off somewhere else, you know, spiraling about something relatively small. So I find that really helpful, and I've seen such a huge impact on clients that I work with in developing techniques that are a little bit different for each person, but that involve that kind of emotional literacy of learning what's going on with me and my emotions, and how does that look in my body, and what can I do about it.
And a lot of what you've just said then is exactly what I would do working with someone with that anger, is your body tells you before you kind of kick off that something's not right. So as you said, with the tingling in the back of your neck, the vibrations, your body will be telling you that, you know, you're feeling angry, you're feeling an emotion. And people will quite often say to me, how do I stop myself from reacting in that moment because I've been triggered? And as you've said, it isn't as easy as just when you're having a bad moment, just picking it up and running with it. It's almost about, you've got to make this your life. This is almost how you now have to live like this day in, day out. So that when you have that bad moment, because you've lived your life in a different way now, it takes away the impact that it would normally have.
Yeah. And I think that can be a disappointing answer for people sometimes, honestly, when they first hear that there isn't a magic bullet that you can just try for the first time and it's going to work. Well, it was for me anyway.
Absolutely. Because people... you know, we don't want to have to put massive amount of work in for things to happen, do we? We want quick results. We, you know, we've got places where we can get food quickly. We can do the internet quickly. We can shop online. We want everything now. And so we want those results. And to be told, like you said, no, that's going to take some time. It's a change of life. It's a lifestyle. It's not the answer that people want, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think you're right that we live in this kind of instant world now, and it's having such an impact on our attention spans and that need for kind of quick fix, dopamine hit, you know, reward. And yeah, when we come back to people and say, I'm afraid you're going to have to practice this.
Yeah.
It can be difficult because, you know, we've learned to live in a way that's kind of out of sync with that. So
I
really kind of resonate with that. But it's, for me, I think once you've got something in your muscle memory and it's there, it's kind of, it's in your body. You've done it enough times that your body knows subconsciously and your brain knows subconsciously what to do in the situation where you need to delay your response to a stressful situation or whatever it is, that it's there. So it's not, it's maybe not as difficult as it sounds to build up that practice and to get it, some of these techniques into your muscle memory and into your subconscious a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say it's less of a conscious effort then, isn't it? It's just a more of a day-to-day response. So tell me then, how can our listeners work with you? What can you do to help our listeners if they want to build up their resilience, or how can they work with yourself?
So I offer one-to-one coaching. Quite often that's online, but I do really love to work in person. That involves coaching in the more traditional sense, where it's very client-led. I'm there to hold space and help people set goals and figure out how we're going to work towards them, and asking good questions to help people to figure out what it is that they need and to spot patterns and to come up with the answers themselves, because that's, you know, all the answers are within you already. That's the idea. So it's not me telling you what to do, but I might sometimes make some suggestions, and particularly where that's about things like sort of somatic practices and sort of, you know, embodiment techniques that they might want to try to support them through difficult conversations or presentation and performance and kind of nerves with speaking up, or, you know, whether it's about kind of showing up authentically and communicating authentically, all of that stuff. There's lots of techniques that I can offer and that I can teach, but it's different for everyone, so there's not a kind of prescriptive list of here's what to do, and it's the same, you know,
absolutely
a sheet. So, you know, that's coaching, and I also offer breathwork sessions. So that bit about learning how to breathe with your diaphragm and breathe in a way that's going to really quickly help you regulate your nervous system back to a place of calm, I offer that as well. I'm going to be running retreats starting next year, with the first one up in Scotland, in Angus, north of Scotland. Hopefully we get the good weather for it, fingers crossed. It's okay though, it's all mostly indoors. So I offer all of that, and then I work with teams and groups as well, quite often kind of workplace based and sort of socially focused projects, to help people have difficult conversations and kind of navigate things that they're stuck with as a team, particularly around kind of power and identity and things like that. So those are all the things that I offer. Is this where I do the plug of how to find me?
I was going to say, yeah, so if you give us your links and I will put them in the bio of the podcast, is that all right?
Yeah, that's fantastic.
By all means, you can say them now, and then I'll put them in the links anyway.
Well, you can find me on Instagram if you look up Live and Breathe Coaching. So just all one word, Live and Breathe.
Okay.
With an E at the end, not breath. I am also, my website is liveandbreathe.info. And you can look me up, Mo Ford, on LinkedIn.
Brilliant. Mo, it's been an absolute pleasure.
I've loved this. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy listening to the episode and learn some tips on how to manage your emotions in a healthy way. If you've been affected by anything in the podcast, or if you want to share your feedback or questions, please email claire@angermanagementcoach.co.uk. Thank you for listening, and do remember, you have the power to calm your emotions and communicate effectively.